Awesome to welcome Adam Pike to the Basketball Podcast. Adam Pike independently covers the Memphis Grizzlies and Memphis Hustle basketball teams from a coaching and X's and O's perspective. Today, we're going to examine the Noel LaRoche offense that was used by Memphis last year and the Miami Heat this year and dive deep into the concepts to be able to give you insights into this offense.
Hey, coach, a brief interruption of our podcast. You know the best player development is coaching development. So let's work together to get your entire basketball organization or program unparalleled expertise and access to Basketball Immersion's group memberships. It's affordable and your players will thank you. Contact us today, basketballimmersion.com, contact page, or DM us on X or Instagram. Get your coaches full access to our extensive coaching video library, detailed courses, and modern evidence-based coaching ideas. You can have proven coach development at your fingertips for all of your coaches. Elevate your coaches, elevate your teams, get started now. Basketball Immersion Group membership is where innovation meets excellence. Contact us today at basketballimmersion.com, contact page, or DM us on X or Instagram. Now back to the podcast.
Adam, welcome to the Basketball Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Chris. Very excited to join.
So I followed you for a while. Love your stuff. Love your breakdowns. So many great insights and just shows the intelligence level of so many basketball fans and people that cover the game. Just awesome stuff. So maybe just start, give the listeners an idea of how you got into what you're doing, which is sharing great content on the Memphis Grizzlies and the Memphis Hustle.
Yeah, for sure. So I grew up a Vancouver Grizzlies fan and then followed them when they went to Memphis. So that's the team I really closely follow. I like to follow the draft and stuff too. But for me, I see some other teams in larger markets, maybe like the Knicks or the Lakers, who have really good coverage from multiple sources, or someone like Caitlin Cooper, who covers the Pacers, Samson Folk with the Raptors. So I wanted to do something similar with the Grizzlies and by extension, the Hustle. So that's mainly what I focus on. It's like X's and O's. Not necessarily coaching decisions, but like coaching style, systems, and stuff like that.
You couldn't have picked a better team to cover over the last couple of years. Lots going on in Memphis always. And the reason that we're here is to dive a little bit deeper into the Noel LaRoche offense that the Grizzlies used last year. And of course, the Miami Heat are using this year. So let's start. Maybe give us a 1 minute elevator summary of the LaRoche offense.
Yeah, so LaRoche offense, the first time we really ever saw it was coached by Rob Santacola. He was with Southern Maine and then the St. Joseph Monks in Division III, who now works with the Memphis Hustle. But basically what you're looking at is a conceptual offense where it's a lot of spacing principles, a lot of cutting principles. So it's five out, or it's someone's in the dunker spot, someone's in the playmaker spot, but you're always keeping the shape of the offense. So there's driving gaps, cutting gaps, and similar principles to that. So we saw it last year with Memphis, a little different than we saw it in D3. And then this year in Miami's a little different. In Division III, what we saw is like everyone is so connected. The trigger is like cut and fill, pass, drive, or drive pass. In Memphis, we saw it mostly, it was like a wheel shape. I think JJ Redick was the first person I saw call it a wheel, but I'll go over some clips later. And in Miami this year, it's more focused on spacing and getting below the free throw line from what I found.
So many connections and coaches. I know we can go down a rabbit hole of like where this came from, what it looks like, all the different influences on it. And offense nowadays is influenced by other offenses. And really the beauty and the perfection of any offense is blending all these different concepts together. And you reference teams changing it a little bit to suit their personnel and to suit their people. So that's why we kind of go through the history and kind of dive into it a little bit. And Rob, big shout out, incredible stuff, great innovator, and probably not as well known as he should be in a lot of ways, but former Basketball Immersion member as well. So I'll give him a shout out. But let's start with maybe some of his stuff. Is I see that's what you've got queued up here, and give us a little bit of an outline of kind of how it started.
Yes, Rob Santacola was actually Noel LaRoche's coach. This must have been like 20 some years ago at the D3 level. And from my understanding, it's like about in 2019, Rob had asked Noel for help on implementing a new offensive system. And Noel has been working with Integrity at that point, doing training for years. And what he brought in was a system that's like no handoffs, no pick and rolls, no ball screens, no back-to-back drives. So it's really focused on that spacing, I said. I have some clips from the Monks, which was the last stop he was with before joining. This is like one of the very first examples. So what you're going to see is the pass, cut, and fill, and that's their main trigger. So instead of like a conceptual offense that might have a trigger with a ball screen, a get action, throw and chase, something like that, this is really pass, cut, and you have to relocate after you cut. So I'll just show us an example. So you started in the corner, cut, pass, cut, pass, cut, 3-point attempt. And it's really
Pretty standard, really, concept is the pass and cut concept out of it. Many teams obviously run it out of five out. The difference is here, the shape is generally four out, one in, right?
Yeah, so like it'll start as five out a lot of times, but you'll see it can develop into a dunker spot. So right there, the guy was in the dunker spot when the shot went up. And sometimes you'll see it where there'll be a player in the playmaker spot, which I'll talk about a bit, but that's basically right there. Playmaker, it goes back to five out, keeping the shell, and then you get the cut after the pass. So it's a lot, and even though it's like a four out, one in, it's still the same idea as a five out, because when you're in the dunker spot, that last defender has to decide between helping on the drive or helping on or staying on his man. And if there's like an empty corner, then like the helper isn't as close. So the idea is really you want to keep the same shell all the time throughout the possession. And even dunker slash playmaker is still like conceptually a five out offense, even if it's like the physical alignment is four out, one in.
And the
So I
goal is
hope.
to create space to drive. And that is one of the problems. Coaches, we talk about this a lot on the podcast, is yeah, we have to say we're five out and we have to say we're positionless because that's good for parents, good for development, all those different things. But at the end of the day, staying five out is not good offense and it doesn't create as many gaps to be able to drive. Positionless and spacing. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, so like you said, positionless is a great example. The Heat are doing that a lot this year with LaRoche as a consultant, but it's basically any player is going to be able to initiate the offense, you grab the rebound, you dribble up, doesn't matter like what your positional designation is on a box score sheet, but you're going to go in and you can start it however there's like wing entry or corner entry. Here they're just starting from the top of the key and we see the cutting, but you can see number two right there. That's like point guard size player. And he was just in the dunker spot. And he can replace like a traditional number one is a lot larger here. So he's going to cut right to the corner. But he can replace him in the dunker spot. He can replace a guard or a wing size player, really anyone. It doesn't matter who is playing what position. It's everyone is positionless offense. And here's that. So that's a playmaker spot example. Number two, again, cut to the dunker spot in that one. So see, they don't really care who's where. Now, when we saw it with Memphis last year, I'll point it out a little later, it was a little different. They had to make some considerations with players like Zach Edey. But really, what you're looking for at LaRoche, the D3 level, is you want everyone to understand their responsibility and they all share the same positional designation slash responsibility.
How deep do they go, or do you understand creating space off of cuts is one thing, but then understanding where to go after the cut so that you're not taking away your teammate's space is an important part of this. We say get into space, get out to space, but it doesn't necessarily mean sprint out to space. It means sometimes you hold the dunker, you said the playmaker. Talk to us a little bit about that respacing concept, which seems to be so powerful and seems to be talked about a lot about when it comes to this offense.
Yeah, so the respacing concept, a lot of it is you're going to read your teammates. There might be something like if you're passing, you have to read whether that player is going to drive or he's going to shoot or he's going to pass again. If he swings again, then the original passer was supposed to cut. But if you pass and he's driving, then you can't be cutting into the same spot. Now, after the drive, if it's not like effective or they don't get a shot off, he's going to pass it back out. You don't want another drive coming into the paint because you already have at least one defender there and then the other man's defender. So the decision is on that guy if he has to cut out to the spot. So it might be like if he drives, he cuts out to the far side corner, and then the person that was in the corner is going to read where he cuts and he's going to lift to the wing and it's all going to restart. So it's pass, pass, drive, and you're going to read and react based off that.
And coaches, if you're watching this video on YouTube, you can see the kind of the more constant motion that the Division III team runs. Whereas at the NBA level, it's not as much constant motion from off the ball, was one of my general impressions. Was that a fair distinction, Adam?
Yeah, and they're a little slower to relocate a lot of times after an initial drive. It's definitely not as active as we see with like the Monks or with Southern Maine. And it's less like all five players are reading and reacting together. And it's more one player does the trigger maybe, and then you'll get a little movement along the perimeter. So I'll show that in a little bit with Memphis.
And I just want to qualify that for coaches because one of the important things to understand the difference, and I think we all understand the difference, is at the NBA level, players are much better at creating their individual advantage. Whereas at the Division III level and say high school level, youth level, they need a little bit more catching it, coming to the ball on a replacement cut, being able to attack that space with an advantage already rather than having to just statically create the advantage.
Yeah, and someone like Miami or last year with Memphis, it's like they're not running a lot of pick and rolls, but they are still running some with the D3. You're going to see like, there's no pick and roll. So it had to be adapted to that a little bit.
Yeah, I haven't seen one pick and roll. Talk to us a little bit about that philosophy and maybe some of the good and some of the challenges of not running a lot of pick and roll, because I think in Memphis we saw both.
Yeah, so some of the good is you don't bring two defenders together to defend one action. So you don't have, let's say, you don't have traditional drop coverage or like a head. You don't have to read the pick and roll coverage that the defense is playing. And it creates wider driving lanes. Something like when you have five out and it's fully based off like a drive, then you can get stuff like gap help. But sometimes you bring three defenders together to guard one pick and roll possession with the drop defender, the ball defender, and then the gap help. With this, you're creating much wider lanes. One of the challenges Memphis had last year a lot was the players on the team were really used to using pick and rolls as a trigger. Like Ja Morant had been among the league leaders every season he's been in the NBA, and even at Murray State, as his possession starts with a pick and roll and he's going to try to attack the rim. And the other thing is the player setting the ball screen, a lot of the times it was Zach Edey. And when you're talking about positionless basketball, Zach Edey fits into like he's a single position. He's 7'4". His best skill is probably rim running, so he's not going to be on the perimeter a lot. And Memphis, they had to make some changes to like the wheel pattern or the cutting pattern to implement that, which
You
made it a
mentioned the wheel
little less
pattern, and
positionless.
you mentioned the wheel pattern. I know that comes up a little bit. You referenced obviously that concept from JJ saying that, and then we famously have seen Draymond talk about this a little bit in terms of the penetration reaction, the respacing type of stuff. Can you highlight that a little bit for coaches?
Yeah, so one thing I'll just show, just like one more play. So we'll see how everyone is cutting and reading off of each other. So it's not necessarily like a scripted pattern like we're going to see with the wheels, but it's the same idea, like drive left, everyone cuts left, drive right, cut right, and fill behind on right. Now,
So drive
moving.
left, move left, drive, move right, and see that pattern go from there. But before you go there, one other thing, because we can dive into that with video, just as you're finding the next clip here. Again, coaches, you can listen to this or you can watch this. But one thing that I saw with the Monks from your edit when I watched it before was like sometimes there's double cuts happening. And I didn't see that as much at the NBA level, right? Where coaches, if you're thinking about this, I pass the ball to Adam, I cut. Traditionally, the next player filling that space fills the space and holds the space, but often that second player on the replacement cut was cutting again. Normally, that is triggered by denial pressure, but sometimes they were doing it regardless. Do you have some theories behind that?
So like the difference in the NBA, a lot of the time you're going to get just like a slot cut instead. And also in the NBA, I feel players are more prone to driving or shooting. They don't, without the assist, like years and years of practice or even like the training camps they get, I think it's harder to make the pass decision. And it's easier for a player to just drive or shoot a lot of the time, even if it's not the highest quality shot they're looking for. So I feel like you're going to get less movement. You're going to get less pass decision. You're gonna get more
Awesome. I
pass
want to
decision.
highlight that. It is less movement at the NBA level than it is at the Division III level. And that's intentional and somewhat personnel driven. And obviously, it's somewhat just because the gravity on the NBA court is much different than a Division III court as well, or a high school court.
So these are all 3-point makes because I was working on a video for this, but this is basically Memphis Grizzlies wheel pattern. And we'll show some clips and describe it. But what you're looking for is really everyone following the decision makers. So Bane has the ball right here. He's in the far corner from where the camera is. But what we're looking for here is based on his decision, we want to see what the other four players on the court react to. So Adama has the ball here back to Bane. So when you see the drive, Bane is going to drive to his left, and there's three players on the other side. So Adama is going to slide away from the top of the key to the wing. Smart's going to make the cut from the wing to the corner, And Edie, who's in the dunker right now, is going to do a dunker cut just to the other side of the dunker. And it creates a long closeout. Jazz zero at the top of the screen. He's in the lane to provide gap defense help. And you can see that the long closeout situation here means Aldama has a wide open three, and that's from the slide away cut.
So the wheel action is literally this concept that I call push-pull. Many coaches call it that. If you dribble towards, you're pushed, and you dribble away from, you're pulled, which means that drive went left, so everyone moved left. The difference is obviously what does the player at the rim do, and that's the key feature that's a little bit different in this. Just keep going with these clips so you can drive this point home, because I think this is really important for coaches.
Yeah, so that's the decision they made with Aldama. Here you'll see they have five shooters on the court. Jay Huff can shoot. So the consideration when you're cutting is a little different. Now, this one is initiated by a trigger. That's what makes Memphis different is, sorry, it's a ball screen trigger. They ran Tomas Isolo was one of the assistant coaches last year, now the head coach of the Grizzlies. The Iverson follow empty trigger is really that's one of his babies. He runs that all the time. But the same concept applies where it's wheel pattern. So you'll see Jaw. We got Jake LaRavia cutting from the corner to the dunker, and we got Jay Huff, who was at the top of the wing. He's going to make the corner cut on the weak side. And long closeout situation again because the head was turned.
So components of that, just pause for a second, but components of that is obviously drive, and you're driving towards a two side. The corner cuts and the 45 fills the corner, and that's part of this movement that I think is really effective. And traditionally, like certainly 10 years ago, more tradition would be the 45 burn cut, but cutting from the corner and filling that corner creates more space and obviously creates more variability, I feel, for the defense. And that component you see over and over again in this offense, don't you?
Yeah, and Draymond was one of the players who mentioned it last year. It's unique and it's weird, is what he called it, because it's not like the normal cutting rotation or cutting pattern that you'd see. So here it is again with Zach Edey, and we'll see Jake has the drive here, and he's going to get the same thing where it's Aldama cuts to the corner, two side action, and you're going to get Luke Kennard, who cuts to the corner from the wing. And
Corner cut, corner fill.
corner cut, corner fill, yeah. So this one looks like it's going to be high-low action at first, but it gets denied here. But you can see Jake LaRavia just very carefully, he just like dribbles into the paint, and you get the same thing. Two-side action, slide-away cuts.
The playmaker spot. Do the NBA teams refer to that, or was that just for the feature of the Monks?
Yeah, so Coach Jenkins mentioned the playmaker spot. I'll open a clip here. From this is Army Black Knights women's college basketball team from 2020, 2021. Noah LaRoche, he consulted with the team to set up their offense. So I can show just a quick example of what the playmaker spot's going to look like. It looks a lot like post-up positioning, but we'll see it here. And there's going to be a few like symbols. So the arrow is the playmaker spot. Then you're going to see the cut, clear out the side. And it's basically a post-up possession at that point. But you don't have to necessarily dribble in, or sorry, you don't have to necessarily set it up like that. You can dribble into the playmaker spot, or you can do post-entry passes like typical NBA you'll see. There's playmaker spot, cut, and the post-up possession. Now, Taylor Jenkins did, or Coach Jenkins did mention the playmaker spot last year, but Memphis used it a lot differently. It didn't look like the Monks or what the Army women's team was using. I'll show you here. It was almost always featuring Jaren Jackson Jr., which means it wasn't the positionless playmaker spot we saw. And you don't get the post-entry cut, clear. You get the similar spacing idea where it's Jaren outside and then there's four players on the perimeter, but you don't get the playmaker spot anywhere close to the same as like at the D3 level. It's mostly just for post-up possessions, or if it's like a double team and on the previous possession they ran a double team, you can run a help beater to beat that, kind of like a pin and flare or like a burn cut, 45 cut. But mostly, no, it's just being filled up for Jaren Jackson Jr., the playmaker spot in the NBA.
So mid post and a lot of back end post ups and a lot of playmen off that, and then coaches a lot of Bilboa action off of that for different teams, not if even necessarily Memphis, but just different teams run a lot of Bilboa action off that as well.
Yeah, so you look at this possession, you don't get anywhere close to the movement that we saw in the Army Black Knights possessions.
That's
Again,
what it
a little
looked
more
like before
static at the
Memphis.
NBA level because there's more space and there's more gravity on the court. And obviously, individuals can create their advantage much easier. So really good clip to highlight those differences. That's excellent.
Yeah, I can show just like a couple clips from the Miami Heat just to since he's there this year. But we're gonna get the same thing. So this one they actually are gonna dribble into, but you're not gonna have the movement. You're gonna have basically just the
So,
static pattern. You get
coaches,
both foot.
Wiggins dribbles into a Barkley, becomes the playmaker.
Yeah, and here you're gonna see post-entry pass to Jaime Jaquez and middle four out spacing and just a post-up possession. So it doesn't look anything like the movement patterns we saw before.
Since
I
we're
think
on
it's
Miami, and
another
I know we're
Barkley
going to go
action.
back and forth a little bit, but maybe just pause for a second as we talk about Miami. What do you feel is one of the differences? It's not that it wasn't successful in Memphis, but clearly Miami has had a little bit more success in terms of their personnel being able to apply these concepts. Do you have a theory behind that?
The running theory would be, Eric Spoelstra has been in the NBA for a long time. He's coached a lot of these players like Bam for a long time. And I think the Miami Heat organization already have the Spoelstra buy-in, particular to maybe the different offenses. I feel Miami has always played a little more egalitarian than a team like Memphis has played. So the personnel is probably better suited to a more egalitarian offense where it's a whole bunch of people sharing the ball together instead of one player having 30 to 35 usage.
Yeah, it's such a great point. Like, it's always how Bam has been with them anyways, in a sense. So this is good for them. And then players like Hawkes in particular look so good in this offense. The ability to be able to create space and then turn a drive into a post up in the Barkley, and just so many multiple skilled players as well. And Norm Powell clearly as well. We know how good he is, and him in space has been really fun to watch as well. Is it really just a case sometimes of being able to adjust your mindset from not running a lot of ball screens?
Last year in Memphis, closer to the end of the year, the adjustment just didn't work. At the beginning of the year, they tried to run fewer ball screens, but then eventually, even with the wheel pattern, they had to implement the ball screens back and move away from the five out offense. So it didn't work there, and they made the decision to move on. But yeah, for Miami, they've already decided they're going to run fewer ball screens, but also someone like Bam, who used to run like a lot of maybe elbow like DHO actions or a lot of
A lot
elbow
of DHO,
playmaking
yeah.
actions. Yeah, he's probably the leader of the team, and just collectively they all decided that this is going to be the offense they run, which is very impressive. They just basically changed it overnight, and it's been very impressive.
So the argument in Memphis a little bit was that, like, it really did help Jaren Jackson almost an NBA level season, clearly, and it didn't necessarily help some of the other players. Is that kind of what you think of that offense now in terms of Memphis?
Yeah, like it really helped Aldama, it really helped Jake LaRavia and Jaren all NBA almost. But yeah, the players who probably at the beginning of the year, like Bane had a hard time adjusting, particularly with Bane, I think it was like the drive pass shoot decision. And then with Ja Morant, I think it was mostly just like he needed that ball screen trigger he felt to be more effective. And that's kind of what they went back to this year, you can see.
Yeah. Awesome. Can you highlight a little bit for us then some of the differences maybe between how Memphis ran it and how Miami ran it?
Yeah, I'll pull up some of the Miami possessions. So Miami again, when the most important thing here for them is going to be the spacing. So they really want to create the gaps here. So at the top of the key, you're going to see, I think that's Khalil Ware. He starts the initial cut to create the spacing and the driving angle. No driving angle, pass, pass, decision, pass back. And then there's another cut there from Wiggins, and you're going to get the corner drive from Norm Powell. It's not necessarily the same wheel pattern. Norm Powell, when he drove there, you didn't get everything moving the exact same, but you did get like the constant cutting and relocating to open space to create those driving gaps.
The Miami one more closely reflects the Division III one in that sense, but there's just more pass and cut type of movement to it, it seems.
Yeah, there's a lot more pass and cut movement, and there's even fewer ball screen triggers than there was at Memphis. You're not going to get like the same movement again, but the passing and cutting, yeah. There you see like drive to the basket. Let's try to find another one.
And we don't know the exact cue they're telling players, but generally the feel for watching Miami in particular is that if they have a matchup, then they're supposed to attack the matchup and then be able to play off of that decision, right?
So you could and create the lane for them. You could see like the gigantic gap they had there for the driving lane for Norm Powell.
Here's another one. So it's, again, like anyone can initiate, but Khalil Ware, he's gonna cut big driving lane, and I think that's Davion Mitchell has the path to the basket just 1-on-1. The other thing with Miami is with the spacing. They want a lot of the times they want clear. Let's see if we have a clip somewhere here. There's another driving lane, but it's going to be the cutter at the top is going to have a very clear one side. Okay, so here's like an example of that spacing. So you get the ball at the top of the key, far from the camera, and on the camera side, you're going to have four players all on the same side of the basket. You're going to have Jaime in the dunker spot. Khalil Ware is going to make the cut here, and then you're going to have the other two extended beyond the 3-point line. And it's basically just another huge gap driving lane, and he's going to go 1-on-1 with his defender. And that's a lot of that is Miami wants to start the possession or at least get the initial drive. They want to be under that free throw line. And I think Bam Adebayo even said it, like when he was on Peacock or NBC, something like that. He called it a random stat and said, if you can get below the free throw line, like the expected points per possession is a lot higher, but it's not a random stat. It's a real stat. So you're going to see again the clear side, the drive, and he's all by himself. And that's what the static motion is, where on the 1-on-1s, like everyone's watching, but then there's stuff broken in. Like on a drive, you get to occupy the corner, so you have the passing lane, and then maybe someone's gonna do the burn cut like they normally would, something like that. Like in a classic offense.
Hey, coach, a brief timeout from the podcast to bring you the Analytics Minute, sponsored by Hoopsalytics. Do you know which players should be taking what kind of shots? An analytics system like Hoopsalytics can help your team make better shot selection decisions. You can track every kind of shot each player takes, where the shots come from, rate the shot quality, track if the shot was contested, and see the results. For example, see which players are taking mid-range floaters and measure the results versus catch-and-shoot jumpers. As an added bonus, Hoopsalytics shot charts are fully interactive, so you can filter by shot distance, shot type, or even specific areas of the floor. Then watch video clips of all those shots or see the points per shot. Hoopsalytics brings the most powerful analytics to teams of all levels. It's easy to use and affordable. It's like AI for basketball coaches. Visit hoopsalytics.com/ball today. That's hoopsalytics.com/ball. Today to learn more and start analyzing your game for free.
The other thing I want to talk about in particular is the connection between this, and I know you dove into it a little bit, the connection between this offense and player development and the synergy that's supposed to exist between those two things. We develop our players, we send, and especially in the modern era, we spend so much time on individual player development and how that connects to this offense in terms of being able to use your individual skills.
Yeah, so I know. So last year, it was Noah LaRoche who worked with Integrity, and Joe Boylan was one of the other assistant coaches they had, who was previously head of player development for Minnesota. So he's a big believer in CLA, the constraint-led approach, and using that to train players. And he recently released an article where he wrote about McDaniels on Minnesota and how he became like a much more improved player because he was following these little CLA principles. And like the small-sided games that they have. I've seen one where it's the Monks running offense with Noah LaRoche as the instructor, and it's just a 3-on-0. They're just cutting, passing, relocating, 3-on-0, just practicing that over and over until they get it right. And then they incorporate the fourth player, then they incorporate the fifth player. So it's all basically working together on those small-sided games, but then together as a team to get there.
So there's a little bit of pattern recognition coaches, which can be developed in different ways. And then obviously the power of this offense are the basketball decisions. And Joe and Noah have both been on the podcast talking about that. So you can go back and listen to their episodes talking about kind of player development in a CLA approach. But obviously the importance of making a decision, and that's what this offense is all about. And generally what we're seeing, Adam, a lot is we're seeing one-on-one score, but when you draw two, pass. And that's really what's showing up constantly through this. And that to me is like connecting CLA and running offense.
Yeah, and then on the other end of that is once you make the pass, it's really the 0.5 decision making that gets talked about all the time. Whether you're going to pass or you're going to drive again or you're going to shoot. Both players really have to make that decision.
I mean, it just happened there with Davion Mitchell coaches, but The ability of a player, and I think this is really important to inform all of us about better youth development in particular, is the ability of a player to be able to be confrontational, to take a TJ St. Lines, who's now with the Knicks, but like to drive through people rather than around people. And you're seeing this constantly from Miami, how they're being confrontational on their drives, they're trying to drive through people. But then what David Mitchell just showed us is that ability to be able to attack and counter. Like they don't use all these like moves to shake people. They're trying to drive through people, and then if they get stopped, they might counter once, but then after that, it's move it and play out of that. And they really do a much better job than what you saw in Memphis in terms of that.
Yeah, agreed. Last year, one of the things was, and this came from the development side, but I forget the name for it now, but when the player would drive to the basket and they would stop, play off 2 feet. So that's like at the basket. That was more of a counter move when you're already completed the drive. But yes, playing physically like on the drive was definitely different in Miami than we saw in Memphis last year.
We call it a protection plan, Adam. It's a protection plan in the sense that what happens when your drive gets stopped? Really important part of coaching is like telling players, okay, what happens on dead? What happens when you don't have a shot? And how do we get out of trouble so that we can re-trigger and get an advantage again? And that's what you're referring to. And you're seeing this throughout these clips, by the way, coaches, when you get a chance to watch Miami play, you'll see these opportunities. They don't always score and they don't always create an advantage on these drives, but they sometimes trigger an advantage on the protection plan part of this. That's a Doug Novak term, coaches, if you want to go listen to his podcast.
No, yeah, that's perfect. Yeah, the re-triggering is very important too. So
Did you
we
get a
talked
feel
about.
just before you
Oh,
go on? Did you get a
yeah.
feel for players a little bit? It would strike me, and this is one of the reasons that I wanted to have you on, is it strikes me that players would enjoy this. The ability to be able to, again, be individually the best version of themselves and to be able to have space to be able to show that.
Yeah, when you hear Norm or Bam talk about the offense, they were very excited to talk about it, I find. And they even did the demonstration with Dirk and Nash. I feel they really enjoy it. Last year in Memphis, it did allow the role players to be their best selves. And in training camp, there was a lot of positive feedback that we heard on media day about learning the new offense. By the end of the year, I don't know if it suited everyone, but the players who do enjoy it, and maybe not the primaries on every team, but yeah, they seem to enjoy it a lot because it's really fun. And it's not like you're not teaching players plays like you said at the youth level. I think this would be very applicable because they're not learning plays all the time, but they're playing just based off triggers and quick decisions.
Principles, triggers, and then reading their advantage, and then obviously informing them about the type of shots that are good in terms of that. Some of the shots being taken at the NBA level aren't necessarily good shots for the youth level coaches if you're thinking about it that way. But it is really good. It gives them kind of a conceptual pattern to be able to attack advantages and then be, again, the best version of themselves. Adam, I say this all the time to players and coaches, but the beauty of basketball, for especially at the development levels, is all five players should be able to handle the ball and attack because that's the best part about it. Nobody, when I played hockey, and you're Canadian, so we can relate to this, is like somebody at one point decided I was a defenseman. And then I quit playing hockey because I was like, wait, I don't get to go shoot all the time and try and score. It's not as much fun, but basketball solves that for us because all five players should. So that's one of the beautiful things about this offense, coaches, to be able to look at and consider for the youth level, especially.
Yeah, and I feel like a lot of the innovations in Europe, like over the past couple of decades, have really been like teaching everyone all the positions and the responsibilities on the court. Like when you watch Jokic, you can see he might have grown into a 7 foot body, but he understands where everyone is supposed to be, what everyone's role is supposed to be. And that's outlier example, but I feel like I'm not an expert on the player development side, but I feel like America and the American system is catching up to that.
Can you help us? Because I think the sticking point for a lot of coaches, even when I share stuff about conceptual offense, like I think they get too stuck on five out, four out, and you've already referred to it as it's constantly changing shapes to a certain extent anyways. But talk to us about that kind of that fifth player, whether they're in the dunker, they're in the playmaker spot. Do they stay there all the time? Sometimes it seems like some of these teams, as you said with Zach Edey, they stay in a certain spot, but so it's more of a four out type of movement pattern. But with the Heat, they generally seem to move players in all five spots, right?
Yeah, they do on the drive I showed where you'll get the empty side and it'll be a one-on-one decision. They will tend to occupy the dunker spot. And that's because you really want to get that last or that low man to make the decision whether he's going to help or if he's going to stay on his man. That makes the decision to either finish at the basket or help him or get help from the dunker spot. Same with if they're in the corner, you can occupy the corner spot. And you got to let the last, he's going to either make the decision to help off his man or stay in the corner. And that's going to make your decision as the driver a lot easier. So, like in Memphis, we saw Edie might do a dunker to dunker cut, or he might do like a circle cut where he's in the dunker spot and then comes around just in the paint to be a passing outlet. And because otherwise, like his man is just going to be there and he can play too, but you don't want him to be able to defend both the decision and the last. So, like for Memphis, yeah, they made that commitment to Edie since they drafted him. This is how we're going to incorporate you in the offense. At the D3 level, everyone was replacing each other. But with Miami, I've noticed a little more. It's like Khalil Ware and Bam Adebayo will stay in those dunker spots, but they're also inverting the floor a lot where they'll put like Davion or Jaime in that dunker position, and then they'll move based off the relocation.
Yeah, definitely a big thing over the last few years is putting a guard in the dunker spot in the NBA. And to inform people a little bit, there's a lot of reasons to do that. But one of the biggest reasons is you remove the big help at the rim. So often it's small help at the rim, which is a huge part of that as well. But I don't know if you dove into it much or if you have clips of it, but Ben Taylor, Thinking Basketball, shared some stuff from this breakdown. And one of the things they did with Jae Huff is that he would actually back out of the dunker spot to fill the get back to the 3-point line, which is where his comfort level was. So he might sometimes start in the dunker, but instead of like always emptying under the rim and that dribble drive kind of reaction, he would back out. Did you get into that much in terms of some of your breakdowns?
Yeah, so really the consideration was for Edie and Clark are going to make the decision to go from dunker to dunker, but someone like Jae Huff or Jaren Jackson Jr., they can shoot. I don't know exactly if I have any examples of that ready, but like the second clip here was Jae Huff, and he's not going to stay in the dunker on this possession. He can go from anywhere on the floor.
They're more five out right now for sure with Jay, right?
Yeah,
Yeah.
they're more fight. And even though they're going to go with the Iverson trigger, but you can see he's still above the break there. And then he's going to cut to the corner. And Laravia was going to make that corner to dunker cut. Now, if Edie was in that dunker, you'd have Laravia bypass the dunker and then relocate back to the corner, which is a consideration they had to make. But when you have a player like Huff, you're going to get Laravia to cut to the dunker. And Huff or a similar player can cut from the dunker to the weak side corner as the passing outlet. That's how you get like the different players in, and that's more of the positionless side, even though Huff is like over 7 feet tall. That's how you get all the five players playing in the same role.
Adam, again, what's fascinating about this offense and kind of this conversation is obviously, there's parts of it that has really worked and there's parts of it that have been a bit of a struggle a little bit. But talk to us about blending it, particularly with kind of the different coaching and the different coaching tensions that they had in Memphis last year.
Yeah, so Memphis hired both Noah LaRoche last year and Coach Isolo from who was in Paris at the time in EuroCup. And they tried, Coach Jenkins tried to blend those two ideas together of we're not really going to run ball screen triggers, but we are going to keep the cutting and the player movement decision making, the collective basketball, as Tomasi Isolo calls it. So this is in Paris. There's TJ Shorts. So you're going to see in this example that Isolo is running the similar cutting collective basketball pattern, but he's doing it with a ball screen trigger. And on that, we're going to get the corner and the wing cut, and we're going to get the lift behind. I have a few examples here, but we'll run this one too.
A
This is
five out
extra
ball
on.
screen coaches, and then on the drive towards the two side corner cut and corner fill.
Yeah, so yeah, and I'll rewind. This is like just a strong entry with the double screens, and then we get a high ball screen. And again, it's two on the side. And the player was driving to the left initially. So you get the corner cut, and then you get the wing to corner and the corner to dunker. There is an example in here of them driving towards one side, which I want to look at. Here's like a ball screen driving towards the three side occupied, and you get the dunker relocation, you get the corner to dunker, and you get the wing. Then they're going to go back and you trigger.
Coach Isolo was on the basketball podcast, coaches. It was a long time ago. It was even before Paris, is when he was still coaching in Germany. And he talked extensively about collective basketball. If you want to go reference that, it's on YouTube.
Yeah. And so, like, really, you're getting the same cutting pattern. And this more closely resembles the one Memphis used last year specifically, because there's different rules. So, here's a good one. You're going to get TJ Shorts, high ball screen, and he's going towards the single occupied side. So, on the weak side, you have the double. On the strong side, you have the single occupied. And you're going to notice that there's no cut from the corner to the dunker because that would cut right into the driving lane that TJ Shorts is trying to occupy. So that's like this same wheel idea, but really like that's a rule. You have to occupy that corner so you don't disrupt the drive. And the other thing I want to point out on this one specifically is the corner man on the two side. He's going to read TJ Shorts. He's not necessarily going to follow the drive behind. He is initially, but once TJ gets to the brake line, so the three throw, or sorry, 3 point extended, then the corner man is going to read TJ Shorts. He did do the initial lift. He's going to go and occupy the corner now because TJ Shorts needs a passing. So it's not the completely the wheel you're going to follow left. Really, you have to read that drive to see where he's going to go and where you have to be the passing outlet and corner 3 point make. So
Yeah,
that's
they're
really the
going to
difference we
space,
saw.
not spots. Yeah, they're going to space, not spots. And then off the single side, it's basically hold the single side because there's already a gap created and you're driving towards the double side. We need to create that gap. So that's when the cut and a corner cut and corner fill takes place.
Perfect. Yeah. So that was like the single side one. And then I think most of the others are the double occupied spot. So it was the same idea. And it is like collective basketball, but maybe not as positionless because you're still getting the ball screen. Now, they did run a lot of like guard to guard or ghost screens with their two guards. But a lot of the time, you're going to get the small, big pick and roll and then the cutting based off that.
Good stuff. You can see a lot of the influences blending into this initial offense. And can you talk to us a little bit about Emerson and the influence Emerson has had on this offense?
Yeah, so one coach we mentioned was Joe Boylan, who played Division III basketball at Emerson for Coach Hank Smith. I'm going to touch on two things here. Now, this is Joe Boylan's video that I just saved. So this is some of the Emerson offense that Hank Smith ran. And if we go just a lot of its transition at the beginning, but if we go to some of the half court stuff, a little grainy. We're talking about D3 from mid 2000s, but you can see the same ideas. It's the five out spacing, keeping that shell, and then you're doing a lot of ball movement, a lot of passing, drives, and then the players reading and reacting to each other. So again, a lot of collective basketball. And this is obviously Hank Smith, like his legacy in the NBA these days is enormous. And this is just like another one that kind of flew under the radar of Joe and Noah. They work together on the player development side. I know they have something going on right now outside of the Miami Heat with Noah that they're working on. But this is where the idea started. Even if Noah didn't go to Emerson, he's a similar network where he played in Division III. Coach Santacolo was in Division III. Coach Smith was in Division III. And like all these ideas are just from spending years and years together.
Love it. I love the shout out to the history of it and the kind of the evolution of it and all the different people that have influenced the things that happen. It's beautiful. That's such a beautiful part of basketball. Talk to us about the open concept and the influence on that as well.
Yeah, so the open post offense, I have a clip from Bob Huggins' West Virginia teams. But from my understanding, it's a lot of influence from Laysom Perkins. So Coach Perkins, who ran and taught a lot of open post offense. And Emerson took that as like the base for what they really wanted to do with those teams. So this was even before Emerson. Open post offense, we're getting a lot of same as like ball movement, cutting, reading your man. Saw a flare screen there, but it's relocating and it's a lot of player movement. And this is something that can be taught again at all levels because you're not teaching set plays. And it at least looks fun to me. From what I know, the open post offense is supposed to be a lot of fun to play in. But I didn't have Coach Perkins examples readily available, so this is what I went up with right now.
Coach
But
Perk is
again, that's like,
tremendous. Yeah, he's online. Everyone knows Coach Perkins. He's awesome. Great share of the game. So we're grateful for him and all he's done for the game as well.
Yeah, so these were like two elements that I hadn't seen discussed a lot, like either nationally or by other people. But these are like two very similar offense concepts with the relocating, the spacing, the cutting, collective basketball that like, helped create at least a little bit the Noah LaRoche offense or what Rob Santacola ran in D3.
Well, the influences of this offense in particular are throughout basketball. There's no question. The problem is, and I want coaches to think about this as you listen to this and you watch this podcast, is the problem that I'm seeing in youth basketball with people running five-out offense is it's generally just pass and cut to the rim. And that's not really, it doesn't create fast gaps. It takes too long to create gaps. It allows defense to hold positions. Whereas you watch this, the Bob Huggins one, for example, and then all the Noah LaRoche stuff that you've shared with us, is that it's really random and variable. Sometimes there's screening, sometimes there's dribbles into post-ups, and it's a lot more. Certainly, there's continuous movement that doesn't happen at the NBA level, but there's a lot of variability, which makes it hard to say, okay, we get to just stand here. So move away from just pass and cut and add some variability would be my takeaway from watching this and then the Noah LaRoche stuff that you shared with us, Adam.
And I like what you brought up about the Heat earlier, where they're like being physical. Really, it's like you got to commit to the cut, you got to commit to the respacing, to the screening. It's like it's not just you're not cutting just for the sake of cutting. It's something you really got to commit to. And I find like in the WVU example, they're like very strong at committing to the cut and the rescreening. Little like pin and flares there that they have.
Well, and to be truthful, I'm glad you brought that up too. Like the other part of cutting is, I think we're like in the past, it used to be give and goes, pass and cut to score. I would say that that doesn't happen very often where you just get a pass and cut score. So the value of cutting is about space creation. And I think that's more the modern game. And what we're seeing from the influence of this offense on the game is that the cut is to create space, to be able to drive that space.
Yeah, drive the space. Yeah, you're not necessarily going to get, like you said, you're not going to get a look at the basket every time, but you create that space, relocate, and that's how you set up success for the whole team.
This has been awesome stuff, Adam. I really appreciate you taking the time and sharing with us. And let people know where to find you and where to read you and watch you and follow all the stuff that you're sharing with us.
And no, thanks, Chris. I am on Twitter as Grizzlies Film. I mostly covered Grizzlies and Hustle, but I got really deep into Noah last year, and I'm still following the Heat this year. Also do some college basketball stuff, but mostly you'll find me on Twitter, or I do have a YouTube or Medium where I do post longer articles, but you'll find those just linked on my Twitter.
At Grizzlies Film on Twitter. It's a must follow, coaches. Give Adam a follow. There's so many intelligent people in the game sharing awesome stuff that just helps us all as coaches. And I want you to know, Adam, you're one of them. So keep sharing. And thank you so much for sharing with us and our audience.
No, thanks so much, Coach. I love that you had me on. Very, very excited for this.